bitch please.
Oh, bitch please my ass. You want a sandwich?
Dig that. Oh, hell yeah.
She's a bad man, a devil. I'm a black man in a white world.
If I wasn't a Christian man, I'd probably be kicking in your ass.
Thank you.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the JB's Low Tech Podcast. We've all been going through some tough times here lately, and with today's guests, we'll probably discuss how our minds have been affected by all of what we've gone through in the past year, year and a half. Here next on the JB's Low Tech Podcast.
Well, folks, the season is finally here. What season? Baseball and softball season, of course. Are you ready? What about you players out there? Are you ready? Is your equipment ready? What about that glove you've been using? What about that uniform you've been wearing year after year? Well, I tell you what, if it needs to be repaired, bring it to JB's Glove Repair. He'll have you together in no time. That's JAYBEES Glove Repair. With over 30 plus years of experience, he'll have you ready by game time. That's JAYBEES Glove Repair. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the JB's Low Tech Podcast. It's been a tough year for us all with COVID and social unrest and all the anxiety and stress we've dealt with over the year or so. So I thought I'd bring on somebody to talk about that with us today, and also how it may affect athletes. And today I have Dr. Rick Aberman, sports psychologist, somebody who's helped me in the past and helped many golfers. And welcome to the show, Rick.
Hey, thank you. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. It was good to see you on Sunday, even though it was kind of out of the blue. you were leaving Gopher baseball, and I happened to be leaving Gopher softball, and we ran into each other. So,
well, it was good timing.
Right. Okay. With the stuff that us mere mortals have been dealing with this past year, what have people in the psychology world have seen? I guess, increases in?
Yeah, well, just about everything that we were seeing increases in before only magnified a whole bunch. And so that said, things like stress and anxiety and depression, and all kinds of mental health issues have been on the rise anyway. If you look at a student population, of a university age people, the mental health rates have never been higher pre-pandemic. Oh. And so what's happened during a time of the pandemic itself has just amplified all those things. And it's been really stressful. Quite honestly, I don't know a lot of people that, or many people at all, that have really done all that well this past year. It's been a real challenge for everybody.
Yeah, you can count me in on that. I have to apologize here for a second, Rick. I didn't, I should have started today's show with getting a little background on you for my guests. So if you want to give us an an origin story on how and what made you get involved in or do what you do, and maybe where you went to college and and other things to kind of give a little background.
Sure, happy to. I'm originally from Minneapolis and St. Louis Park specifically, went to high school there. And I did my schooling at the University of Wisconsin in a rare combination of both my bachelor's, master's, and PhD all at Wisconsin.
Okay.
And then upon completing my studies there, I went to work for the University of Wisconsin, and I was the psychologist for the on the sports medicine staff for the University Athletic Department. And in those days, that was a pretty unheard of thing. In fact, at the time, we were the first major college program to have something like that. Somebody on staff to deal with the emotional well-being of not just our student athletes, but the coaches and the administrators included. And so my job was kind of to take care of the mental health of the place. And so it was really new territory in those days. And I would spend a lot of time early in my career, and actually even up to this day, spending more time talking about what I don't do versus what I do. Oh. And really helping educate people about, you know, how we can best be of help. So I spent a lot of time in Wisconsin and at Wisconsin, and then in the early 90s moved back to Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And continued my practice here, and was approached by the former hockey coach at the University of Minnesota, Doug Woog, who I got to know a little bit when he'd bring his teams into Madison. And I was always very appreciative of how Doug coached his teams. And when he heard I was moving back to Minneapolis, wanted to know if I'd be willing to work with his team. And so I had some interest in that. I had been working for the whole athletic department at Wisconsin, which was a pretty large program. We had 24 teams at the time, 1,000 student athletes, and then there was just me.
Right.
And so I didn't want to work for the whole department, but Doug convinced me, asked me if I'd be willing to work with his team. And a friend of his, John Anderson, who was the baseball coach at the time and still is today.
Right.
So I said, we had lunch. I got to know them and decided, this would be a good thing for me to be involved in. And I felt like I could be of help. And today, John and I still continue to work together. What is that? That's going to be 30 years now.
Right.
Cool.
I know.
That's scary. So anyway, that was that's how I got back to Minnesota, and I've developed my practice here, and I've worked with most of the pro teams in town over the years, and I been on the medical staff of the Minnesota Twins for a number of years. I guess I've been with the Twins over 20 years now. And because of COVID and other things, this was my first spring training in 15 consecutive years that I did not attend.
Okay.
And so things are changing, and that's just fine. And
right.
So I still continue to consult with players, et cetera. And, but on a variety of teams, and work with business people as well. So it's the same thing, JB. It's just, people are people. It's just different venues.
Right. Well, I just learned something, because I always thought your original connection with the university was John. And I just learned it was actually Doug Woog, Coach Woog of the hockey program. So
it was, and I didn't know John, and I worked with Doug until he was no longer the coach there, and stopped working with hockey at that point, and was I've been with some other teams at the U, and I've been with most, you know, baseball the whole time, and for the past 10 years or so with tennis, but I've been with a number of teams. Worked with Jerry Kill during his tenure. Mm-hmm. We had a pretty good run then. So
right.
Anyway, it's that's what I've been up to.
Well, it was timely. I had a happy hour yesterday with a couple of present employees of the athletic department, and they asked me who I was going to have on next on the podcast, and I told them you, and one of the guys said, well, this will be interesting because I remember when he first started talking with Doug, and I kind of looked at him and said, Doug, don't you mean John? He goes, no, Doug. So he was right. He started with Doug.
Funny.
But he brought up an aspect that I was planning on touching anyway, but he brought it up. He said, yeah, back then he couldn't believe how people looked at sports psychology as taboo almost.
You know, it's kind of sort of old, I'd like to say old school thinking, although I still know that it continues to exist today in many areas. You know, it was seen as, you know, asking for help was a weakness,
right.
Which, I always have prided myself since day one, working quite hard to help people understand that actually asking for help is really a strength. And, we have all these different resources available to us now. And, so why not take advantage of them? And it's not necessarily fixing broken people. It is more about helping people to be at their best. And why wouldn't you want to do anything you can do to help yourself be happier and do better? I just kind of was always my stance. And so it was, and again, even to this day, it's still a bit countercultural. I mean, when I started, I didn't know anybody who was doing this. And at Wisconsin, we were, like I said, the only program in the country doing that. And now today, there's still, I don't know numbers, but up until very recently, I couldn't say most big athletic departments have somebody. It was seen as a luxury. And when I came to Minnesota, they had no interest in doing that. They just didn't feel like that was something that they needed at the time. Now, and that wasn't necessarily just Minnesota.
Right.
I also remember conversations with the Vikings in the late 80s and with Mike Lynn telling me, he saw no reason why they should have a strength coach. They just didn't see that there was a need for that for their football team. And as silly as that sounds today, that right. was kind of the thinking.
Yeah, I mean, so. The student athlete has made so many demands lately, and in a certain area where they've made demands has been better nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
Better strength and conditioning,
yes,
and better mental health.
Yeah, right. Well, I think we, not only do I think of those things as beneficial, I think it's our responsibility, particularly at the university level, to provide those things, because we know that it's a very stressful environment and we're asking a lot of people, and it's not like people can't handle it. But why would we only focus on the physical side of somebody's ability to perform? You know, what about the psychological side? That's just as important, and I would contend it's more important. We all know people who've had all the talent in the world and just don't perform up to their potential, and that's typically because of what's going on inside of them.
Right.
And helping them learn more about themselves I think that's our job as educators. That's what we're here to do, is to help people learn more, and so that they can go out and contribute in the world and make contributions to society.
Yeah, and being around the athletes that I was around for 40 years, knowing and learning that a calm mind is such a plus to an athlete who's trying to, you know, get their task done on the field,
be no it question.
Throw a football, to throw a baseball, hit a golf ball, swim faster, no matter what it is. If they can tap into their minds and relax and get the clutter away, it just seems that they perform better. Now,
that's right.
Right.
You're right on there.
I have noticed there is a growth within that cottage industry, though, because as I was leaving, they were building an office for psychological staff to be on site at the complex.
Yes. And so that's changing. Now, just a perspective and that's good that they have somebody like that and resources for the student athletes. I think they need it. On the other hand, that's more than 25 years after Wisconsin was doing something like that. And it's been, Minnesota has had somebody, I don't know how many years, but it's relatively new. Certainly within the past 10 years anyway. And I recall being asked to help advise that position and role. And it was, it was good that they were willing to do that. And I am hopeful more and more do that. That said, we still have, college sports isn't the only area in which people perform.
Right. True.
We have youth sports, we have high schools and smaller colleges and people that can't necessarily afford those things. And, it's just, I think in the big operations of college sport, I do feel that it is our responsibility to provide those kinds of things, and it will only be to the benefit of everybody. But it is should not be an afterthought where, well, we have an office and we have somebody part-time who can, see people once in a while, and accessibility and being able to provide staffs and on Major League Baseball, our numbers have really grown. When I started in with Major League Baseball, I mean, there were a few people doing it, but most of it was originated in the chemical dependency area and has now transferred more into, although that's still a big area of focus, more into the performance and mental skills kinds of things. But it's only in the past, I guess it's been almost 2 years now, where I know, having been involved with the league, where the commissioner's office has decided that they were going to make a stronger effort in the area of mental health. And all the professional leagues are doing that right now. But let me tell you, that's maybe 2 years old, and they have a long, long way to go.
Wow.
But at least they're talking.
Right.
At least they're talking.
That is surprising that the sports at that level are moving at such a slow pace. You were just talking about the need of it to happen at the youth level. I mean, college athletes normally come in at 17 and 18. Their whole life has changed. They've moved away from their parents, and now they're relying on other adults that they don't know or know very little of to help guide them through, that 4 or 5 year stretch. But to hear that youth needs it, on one hand, I'm kind of shocked, but then on the other hand, coaching youth sports, as I did for 15 to 17 years, different sports like hockey and football.
And you're a survivor, man. You're a survivor.
Yeah, well, that last couple of years were rough. But I can see where that would come in handy with those young people, because I played, you know, amateur psychologists many a time,
right,
with young,
right,
people, you know, pulling them aside or giving them,
sure,
headset to wear in a car with their parents on the way home so they didn't have to listen to, you know, how bad they performed that day, or, you know.
Sure.
And that's just sad.
Well, it is sad, and I think that was exactly it. You know, this has been left up to our institutions, and, you know, our teachers, our coaches, and maybe our employers. And sometimes people are good at that, and sometimes they aren't. You know, you were the kind of coach when you were doing youth sports that, you know, you were kind of sensitized to that, and you had an awareness of maybe where somebody else was coming from. But not everybody is. The more competitive sports has become, the more pressure there is. But the pressure, you know, on the coaches to succeed and win and further their careers, they're not always taking into consideration the emotional well-being or the physical well-being of those that they're coaching. And so I think the role of leadership today is much more three-dimensional than it's ever been. And, you know, the reality is, it's like I start working with a coach. It's like, you know, I know what my role is. I'm not the coach.
Right.
I'll deal with my thing. You coach the team. Not everybody gets that. I remember having a conversation with a coach here at the university who thought he wanted to be the psychologist, or he didn't want to be. He said he would be, and he was the psychologist. He was a new coach, came over, took over a big program. And I said, well, coach, that's great, because I know I don't coach your sport.
Right.
I'm not the sport coach. I'm the head coach, so I'll do that. But if you're not interested, you think you can do all of that, good luck to you.
Well,
and so that was, you know, that was not uncommon.
Right. Well, that's a sad statement to hear. But no, seeing the things that those, even at age 9, 10, or even younger, the pressures they have to, you know, not to enjoy what they're doing, but to just get better so you can get,
yeah,
to the next level, or make certain this travel team or the A team or this team,
yeah,
or, you know, so you can get a college scholarship, so you can go,
right,
to the pros, and it's just on, and it just wears on those young people.
Oh, it does. Not to mention the tension in those people's families and the houses, and like you talk about the drive home, and what that does to the, you know, the tension between parents and children, and, you know, none of us operate in a vacuum.
No.
We have relationships that are impacted by everything we do. And when we're talking about families, it's not just like you go do your thing without having any influence or being influenced by those that you are living with and were brought up by. I mean, it's just, you know, there's good things with that, and there's not such good things with that. You know, when I'm advising, working with coaches in the college area, and even in the professional level, when it comes to the draft or recruiting, I always tell my front office and the coaches, it's like, look, guys, you're not recruiting a player. You're recruiting a family.
Right.
And
exactly.
And if you think that's not true, good luck to you.
True. So true. I mean, even in the position I had as an equipment person, I had to deal with family members.
Totally. Totally. And
yeah,
don't you think that everybody you dealt with as an individual came with a whole set of family background and expectations, some of it reasonable, some of it not, that you were the recipient of?
Yes.
So you're not only dealing with them as an individual, but they're their own family system that you're dealing with. So
right,
that's really a challenge. And I mean, I've told coaches going into a draft, I said, look, here's the deal. I'll never tell you who to pick.
Right.
But what I will tell you is, if we're going to pick this guy, then we better be prepared to help him and everybody around him.
Right. That's so true. One story I want to tell real quick and then take a commercial break here.
Sure.
Again, I'm talking to Dr. Rick Abelman, sports psychologist. He works with teams at the University of Minnesota, the Minnesota Twins, the Minnesota Vikings, and other pro teams and college teams and businesses. But there was a young lady, and this was very common in the sport of softball until they kind of changed the recruiting rule. They would get verbal commitments from people before they entered high school. Mm-hmm. Now, what people have to understand is that verbal commitment is non-binding.
Correct.
And that kid would still have to continue to perform. And in some cases, if they got injured, the school may just drop that verbal commitment. Well, a young lady, she grew up here in the Twin Cities, made the decision to go to a school down south. Got down there 2 years, found out she hated it. But the spin on the story is, when she made the decision to where she was going to go, her family moved, uprooted their lives, and moved to that town.
Oops. Wow.
And it's like, and when I heard that, I was so blown away. But it was like, why would you make that decision?
Yeah. It says something about the family's need for their kid to perform or be successful. And that right there, think about what that must have meant to that young woman to have to be able to decide or be honest with the family and everybody else that that's not where she wants to go. That's not where she wants to be, because it's not just about you. Now you're responsible for your whole family. And in some of these cases, in some of the sports, you feel that pressure, not just from your own family, but from your whole community.
Right.
And that's, or your whole state. I mean, that's a lot for a young person. That's a lot for anybody.
And she went down south, found out it wasn't the greatest place for her personally, and transferred back to Minnesota. It was like, so now your family dynamic has been flipped on its head.
No question.
And I was always, and I stated this to the softball coaches, I always thought it was ludicrous and crazy that they would force young people to make that decision anyway before they even have even stepped a foot into high school.
Well, it sounds absurd, doesn't it? And yet I think softball is one of the few sports that was way ahead of everybody else in doing that. That's not so crazy and far-fetched today in other sports,
right?
Where you'll get those early commitments. And I know coaches, that's just the game. If you are not recruiting 9th and 10th graders or having your eye on them, you might be missing out on something, which is crazy in and of itself, especially taking in some sports the growth and the development of kids. You have no idea what's going to happen to these kids.
And that's why I always appreciated John Anderson's approach. Come back and talk to me when you're a junior.
Yeah. Well, that's it.
Your body's developed, your mind's somewhat developed. We know what type of student you are. We know what type of person you are.
Right.
And we can go from there.
To make a sophomore commitment, a freshman commitment, or in a high school, a pre-high school, that's tough. Now, once in a while, you can get lucky, and you can see. But, you got to be able to afford to do that. Not everybody can.
All right, Rick, I'm going to take a commercial break here, and then we'll come back and finish up today's episode. Again, I'm talking to Dr. Rick Abelman, sports psychologist. And when we come back, we'll talk about how he's handled things in this time of COVID, and also maybe touch on sports psychology as far as how effective or how do they reach out to the minority community. But we'll do that after this, here on the JB's Low Tech Podcast.
When you need someone to listen, a lawyer you know and trust.
Congratulations to all the Minnesota businesses that scraped through the last year. It sure hasn't been easy, but we've done it together. And while we certainly need to move forward, it's good to reflect on what we've been through and the many losses. Here at Bradshaw & Bryant, we held a lot of Zoom meetings, increased our phone calls, and have done our best to keep up with all the changes while continuing to provide quality work. We'd like to thank everyone that turned to us with their personal injury and criminal needs, as well as the courtrooms for bringing the community back together to serve justice. We look forward to being part of Minnesota's growth and success for many years to come. I'm Mike Bryant from Bradshaw & Bryant. I hope you're never injured in a collision, but if you are, don't sign anything till you've talked to us.
Find Bradshaw & Bryant, personal injury attorneys at minnesotapersonalinjury.com.
Seeking justice for the injured, Bradshaw & Bryant.
I got pros. I got pros. In different area codes.
And we're back here on the JB's Low Tech Podcast. I'm talking to Dr. Rick Abelman, a friend and a, I will say in some ways a mentor for me in my years in athletics. So, Rick, you had mentioned that this was the first year that you did not attend spring training in a while.
Yeah.
What type of access did the athletes have with you? Was that through Zoom, phone calls, or?
Yeah. Oh, you mean this year?
Yes, this year.
Yeah. So for this past year, continuing today, so I guess from March to a little over a year now, I have been meeting virtually through Zoom or FaceTime or whatever it is, whatever the platform, or on the phone with everybody. I have not seen anybody in person for at least a year in my office. Now, I'm hopeful that that will start to change soon. And there are some clients I have in various parts of the country that we've that's our normal way of interacting anyway. I would prefer to be in person, but that's not always possible. And during the pandemic, I think it's second best, no question. But I will say I've never been busier. We're fairly adaptable human beings. And, I think, in the mental health area, well, in a number of areas, but telemedicine has worked quite nicely for our industry. It's done pretty well. Where it has been a little bit more problematic is in the sports and the mostly in the professional sports, where things are really tight in terms of bubbles and controls and process procedures and things like that, and all that is very good. So we're forced to adapt a little bit, and some of my colleagues have been shut out from their organizations. Others have been a little bit in person, but not a lot. That's starting to change now this season, now that vaccines are more out, and I know for the Twins and other clubs are now being vaccinated as we speak. So I think the reins will be loosened quite a bit, which will be great for everybody. As much as good as it is to see sport, as a fan and for our societal mental health, that's a great thing. It's great to have a game on. I can tell you it has not been a lot of fun for those that are in it. Not that they don't love their sport, but it's been really different. And it's been a struggle for just about everybody, as I said.
I can imagine that. I've not hit in the fact as I've done this podcast. I started in November, so basically I've worked through this whole whole pandemic myself by doing this. This was a godsend for me.
Yeah.
As I was being, you know, I live alone, and I only have the one child in town anyway. I mean, I was blessed that I was deemed an essential employee at where I work on campus these days.
Yeah.
And so I was still going to work, and I still had some human contact, but still.
Sure.
But then you'd come home, and you were I was basically shut off from the world, and I noticed my anxiety level raising and depression and whatnot. And
how could it not?
Right. And sought some help, and we tried some medications, and those didn't work, and actually been able to deal with it naturally. And and like I said, also with this, being able to talk with people and see that the world isn't ending was enough to help me get through that shift.
Good, good. I'm really glad to hear that.
But it's just interesting to hear that teams would shut out.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, right?
Mental health professionals in this time because of what I just stated.
Yeah, yeah. I thought we had we started. I'm talking about Major League Baseball began to have meetings with their mental skills and mental health providers once the pandemic started on a once per month basis. And that was really good. You know, the league wanted to address it. I think it helped everybody feel more connected. I mean, nothing was happening. Everything was shut down. People aren't shut down.
Right.
Places are shut down. People do not shut down, and they continue living. And so, you know, how can we best help those that were here to help? And, you know, and some people are more open to it than others. And that was always, that's a challenge enough. So when you don't have that kind of consistent availability or presence, I think it's like you say, you tend to get, when people feel fear or anxiety, we all tend to feel more isolated. And so we try and stay connected the best we can. But we started these meetings once a month. And then once they got back together, those things stopped. And I always, because everybody got busy with their, you know, their seasons or
right.
Spring training and all that. And I you know, personally, I think that was a mistake. And now it's starting to come around again. Now people are starting to talk about, well, you know, maybe we should, you know, keep these things going because we got something good out of it. But I think we need it now more than ever. And so sometimes, you know, it's kind of like when budgets get tight, you know, we'll let the part-time psychologist go because we can't afford that. And I'm like, well, that's when you need to hire a whole bunch more.
Yes.
You know, but you know, that's the countercultural piece that we're dealing with. That's not just in baseball or sport.
Right.
That's true in our corporate worlds as well, and our schools. And so I think the good news is that there's enough of a presence today within a lot of our sport institutions where it's not a crazy thing or a foreign idea. But boy, I remember those conversations with the NFL Players Association, with the NBA Players, with the MLB Players Associations that I've been involved in, where I was like, well, yeah, it's kind of a good idea, but it'll never happen kind of thing. And because they were seen as threatening. And I think that's one of the things that people fear when you make resources available that are good for people. Sometimes people feel like they have less control, that is, those that are in charge. And I think that can be threatening.
Well, and you made a statement about when things were being kind of shut off.
Mm-hmm.
And even with the access that you did have, was that tough for you not to have that one-on-one contact, you know, face-to-face?
You know, It was, I don't know, it wasn't as hard as I thought. You know, there's things I miss, the everyday interactions of just being around. And it just meant I had to be a little bit more intentional about how I went about things. And I know that there are some people that I'm just going to miss, you know, and not just miss like I long for them, but miss that opportunity to maybe be that resource for them. And I always believe that to be embedded in an organization was the proper thing to do, because that way we can be more preventative and proactive versus waiting for the crisis to occur and somebody's ready to jump off the bridge and then try and help them. I mean, I certainly will help them then, but I'd rather us be proactive as systems and organizations. And I think we've been able to do that in many, many cases. And that's what I hope continues. But, you know, I still found ways to connect with people. And I've been able to increase my capacity because I'm not either at the ballpark or with one particular team or organization. I'm able to kind of spread out more easily. I don't have to take a day and a half to travel to see somebody and give an hour talk and fly back. You know, I can do it from my office, and that's a pretty good thing. I like that.
Well, yeah, that sounds good to me. So over this past year, especially back in November, over the year, we had an election, and part of that election race.
Yeah, I remember that.
Race became a focal point of the election. Yeah. And I know that my anxiety level went up as an African American male. Did you see increases of that in stress and anxiety amongst the minority contingent that you may deal with?
Well, I don't know if it was an increase, but we were able to see it more clearly.
Okay.
And I think that is, which is good. That doesn't mean it's easy or that it feels good, because it didn't. In a way, you know, when you're kind of blind to stress, you know, things are okay. So like, why would you want to look at things more clearly? Because some people believe, because then you're going to get more stress. Well, yeah, but you know, this is what we need. And so I think being able to recognize these things, the stress and anxiety that has always been there, that we may, you know, if we weren't aware of in the past, it's good that we're aware of now, because now we actually have the ability to really connect with everybody. And I think that's critical. Nobody should feel left out of anything, and being able to help people feel more understood is what we're trying to do.
Well, because here's the other aspect of that piece is in the minority community, as we discussed earlier, like when you started this, and coaches would basically have a, you know, no, we don't need that type of attitude.
Yeah, right.
You also find that type of attitude in minority communities, that you're weak, you're crazy,
sure,
we don't want to be around you, this, that, and the other, and they become isolated, and those feelings become even stronger and even more desperate.
Yeah. Oh, I can certainly see that. So I think in controlled environments like sports, you know, we can be more proactive in that and help those people feel less isolated. But we have to be aware of that. And I think you raise a really good point. You know, I think there's the norms that exist. You know, I used to feel that with, you know, teams, like, why would you go talk to that guy? You know, it's like there's something wrong with you. And so, you know, it's just, it's a roll of the eyes, or there's a, this idea that, again, asking for help is a sign of weakness. And there's a lot of peer pressure and communication that goes on within cultures, within groups, within systems and organizations that is not helpful to people feeling connected, but more conducive to creating more anxiety and isolation.
Yeah, it's just, it was, I don't even think it would have been thought of for me as a young kid to even been given the thought of doing those things, or checking in for mental health or whatnot. And
yes. Well, in all fairness, JB, going to see a shrink or a psychologist, psychiatrist or whatever, that was always seen as for the privileged, because those folks had money to pay for that kind of thing. And so you had very wealthy people on the coasts would see, would, you know, deal with their mental health. Everybody else felt like it was a luxury because they couldn't afford to do that. And some of that is based on the economics in terms of their, certainly their socioeconomic status, but also in terms of how the systems were set up. They weren't set up for everyday people. They were set up for the wealthy. And so, you know, it wasn't until the advent of community mental health and trying to kind of demystify that, which I think we need to continue to do, that we really make, we've made a little more progress in that way, but we got a ways to go yet.
Right. I mean, with the very visual death of George Floyd,
yes,
and African-Americans seeing that play out on television,
yeah,
and then all the other deaths that happen around or after that,
mm-hmm,
anxiety level, and then to have a president who kind of stoked the flames of maybe not, yeah, racism, but clearly bigotry.
Well, yeah, sure.
It was not a comfortable time. I'm going to be honest with you. It was not a comfortable time.
I can't imagine what that would be like for you. I know how uncomfortable it was for me. And, you know, that is, it was frightening. It was scary. And people didn't even, half the people never even realized what was happening. And so now that those things are, you know, painfully being brought to our attention, as painful as it is, hopefully we can give it the attention that it needs.
Well, I know you are a busy man as usual. As we close up here, I want people to know that Rick is also an author. Any new books lately, or you want to talk about the ones that you have written in the past?
Well, I would like to say one is in the works more than it really is, but not currently ready to talk about that.
Okay.
I had done a book some time ago with actually my co-author, John Anderson,
mm-hmm,
the baseball coach at the University of Minnesota, based on really kind of the stresses and challenges of coaching and kind of what that was like, and really talking about the kinds of issues that coaches face and kind of how to be able to maintain your sanity as a coach and as a leader. And while it's, yes, certainly sport coach oriented, it really applies to any kind of leader, called Why Good Coaches Quit.
Yeah.
There's another book in which I did not write, but I was the main character in the book, which was called From Red Ink to Roses, which was the story of the University of Wisconsin and how that athletics department began to turn itself around and become going from red ink to roses. And
right.
And that was a gamble and decision that was made, and hope that it was a bold decision. And I think it's still very pertinent today. And it has served them well for the past 25 years, or close to 30 years now. It was about documenting that process. So
yeah, it was.
It
was a major shift in the athletic department where they hired Barry Alvarez, decided to make some other changes behind the scene, and made a logo change and everything. Yes. And from that point on,
the Motion W.
And from that point on, everything just started to take off for the University of Wisconsin in athletics, then helped them, you know, and people fail to see this, but also helps them academically too.
Oh my God. It was one of the best things that they could have done. Now, you may disagree with how it went about or the decisions they made, but having been involved in the management team at those times and during that, being the psychologist during that transition, position was you can either be an athletic department that's based on participation and providing good experiences for the student athletes and a well-rounded program, or you can make a decision where you want to play with the big boys and be in the entertainment business, which is something entirely different.
Right.
And I didn't really have a preference at the time, but what I was pushing for was just to make a decision, because not making a decision is what drove everybody crazy.
Right.
And kept digging the department further and further in financial debt. And so once they made that decision, I'm fine with it. Like I said, I didn't always like what that meant, but I was certainly supportive and still am.
Well, I would say it sounds very familiar to me.
You think?
Any last thoughts before we part company here today, Rick?
No, I really appreciate it. I do want to say, when we were talking about some of the social struggles and being able to reach wider ranges of people, one of the things that you'll see, certainly in the NFL and the NBA, but also in professional baseball, where we have, proportionally less of an African-American presence, but a very large Latin American presence.
Right.
And the emphasis and the trying to meet the needs, not just in the physical and coaching level, but also in the psychological and the mental skills area, by having Spanish-speaking resources for our players has really been impressive. And that is... it's really good to see how a whole field is now developing more multicultural, and some really good strides in that. And so I just wanted to mention that. But JB, I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you. It's always great.
Yeah, I appreciate your time. Your industry has come a long way, but still has a long way to go. But I really wanted people to hear from you. So thanks a lot, sir, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you, JB. Be well.
Yeah, bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was Dr. Rick Aberman here on the JB's Low Tech Podcast, and it might be one of my shorter interviews, but I think it was one of my more informational interviews.
JB
is my name, and f***ing up motherfuckers is my game.
I am Negro, Black, African American,
Black.
Django,
J. B.
Damn, Dolomite.
Great God in heaven, you know.
J. B. Our great Negro sex machine.